Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We talk automotive maintenance and repair this afternoon with our buddy Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive in Hoosick Falls, New York. Gordon has been in the auto repair and service industry for over 30 years, and he knows his stuff. Number to call here is 800-348-2551. It's 800-348-2551. Now, you can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org, or go to Facebook, facebook.com/WAMC Radio, and you'll see a Vox Pop post there, or tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop. But once again, the number to call is 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Ray.
It's been a while, right?
Yeah, I think Thanksgiving kind of got us, and the fun drive kind of moved us a month away.
All right. Well, it's good to have you back. And I guess this time is perhaps a slower time in your line of work, just because everybody's spending all their money on gifts.
Yeah. I mean, people get cars ready for bad weather in the winter, and then Christmas comes, and, you know, you got to shift the spending a little bit, and that's what happens.
Nobody's buying sets of snow tires as gifts?
There are still, some do. Yes, yeah. Some do. And there's, we still have a lot of tires to put on because the warm weather has allowed people to relax and not think winter's coming.
That's right. You can certainly fool yourself, but eventually it'll be here.
To some degree.
All right. Let's go right to the phones at 800-348-2551. Anna in Colony, you're on first.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I got a question on oil change.
All right.
I had a 2014 Odyssey that I used very little of, very low mileage, and my last oil change about a year ago. It has a indicator on the dashboard that says to have 40% oil life on it, and I wonder, is that what I should go by, or a year is too long to have it?
That just goes by mileage, right?
Well, her vehicle, it counts more things than miles. It takes into consideration starts and stops, and it's a kind of a smarter system rather than just pure mileage. How many miles have you traveled in the last year? Do you know? Or how many miles since the last?
Maybe 3,000 or 4,000.
And that's since the oil was changed last, about 3,000 or 4,000 miles. I think that Honda recommends you do it at least once a year, even if your indicator says you still have plenty of time. And I agree with that. Cars that do very low mileage, that sit around a lot, I think it's a good idea to do it once a year, unless you truly have no miles on that car for some reason. So okay. I think you should do it if it's been a year, and just get that counter reset back to 100%. And if you continue to drive so infrequently, do it next year at the same time.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your help.
Thanks. You're welcome. Thanks, Anna. We appreciate the call. Over to Bill. No, Bill is gone. 1-800-348-2551. Bill in Greenville, obviously we just couldn't wait any longer, so.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let me take 2 seconds and give my daughter, Hannah, a quick shout-out. She is studying for the last of her finals and writing a paper, but she is taking a minute to listen to the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's exciting. Don't you think she should be studying?
They say kids of that generation are able to multitask much greater than people of our generation.
Really?
So I don't know if that's true or not.
I think they're just more scattered.
Talk to a doctor. Maybe they could tell you if that's true.
Well, I think we may be having some issues with the phone. Keep trying. I have blinking lights. Who's this on the line? Hello?
Hello?
Who is this? Is this Margaret?
Yes, it is.
Would you be in Greenwich?
I am.
My God, I'm clairvoyant. You're on.
Okay. What is your opinion on Minerva snow tires? I was given a quote today at $139.95, I'd like to know if that seems a little too good to be true, but the man assured me at the tire dealer that they are very good, and I'd like your opinion.
Okay.
Well, what happens with winter tires or snow tires is a lot of spin-off labels and brands come about, and a lot of the big tire makers will offshoot a whole bunch of different names. And
hello?
Hello, can you hear us?
Oh, yeah, I can now, yeah.
You could you hear Gordon?
Yeah, no.
Okay, I'll back up. So tire manufacturers tend to spin off a lot of snow tires or winter tires under different names. So you'll get some unfamiliar names like Minerva, Winter Force. You know, they've got their own terms for them. I don't know that particular brand as to if it's made by one of the big tire makers or if it's a import possibly from China. And I would be a little bit cautious with the Chinese made tire. I think they're all required to pass all of our minimum standards now, but there were a lot of tires that got through that were of poor quality and suspicious origin. And some of them, they were doing things like not blending in enough additives to, for example, ward off ultraviolet rays from the sun. And the tires would crack like crazy in a very short period of time. So I think I would do a little bit of investigation as to who makes them, where they're from, and that type thing.
To be clear, you're not saying that specifically about these tires that Margaret's speaking of.
No, that name I'm not familiar with. But when it comes to snow and winter tires, you see a lot of really crazy names on them.
Well, 139 is not too bad. How big of a tire is it?
I have a Mercedes crossover. I don't really know.
Okay, so that would be a larger tire.
How big of the vehicle? What model do you drive?
It's a crossover, 390 something.
So that's an SUV?
Yeah,
and it's a crossover. They're 2010. They stopped making them. R360 or something.
Okay. Yeah, if that's a pretty substantial vehicle. It's not as big as some of the G L's and stuff like that, but
But this is a big car.
Yeah, I would investigate a little bit more into that tire to be sure you're not putting something inferior on there.
Margaret, thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome, Ray. Bye now.
Bye. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Let's go to Kurt in Nassau. Kurt, you're on.
Hi. I traded in my leased VW thinking I could get a great deal for a new VW, and I did. I think I did. And it has keyless ignition, which is new to me. And being an old driver, I'm kind of paranoid about being locked out of the car. One day, a few months ago, it was still warm. I had the key in my pocket, my jacket pocket, and went in to go someplace for lunch and then got out and realized I had left my key in the car. Well, of course, it didn't lock the door, but I was kind of sweating it. Any hints, any suggestions? What happens when that battery dies and you can't open the door? Because there's absolutely no place to put a key in any of the doors.
Now, I'm not sure of a 16, but I think that there is an actual metal key in your remote that can be pulled out like kind of like a blade.
Well, the key fob itself looks exactly like the same key fobs they've had for, I'd say, the last 10, 15 years.
Yes.
You push the button and the little key flips out. But nowhere in any of the doors or the trunk is there a place to insert it.
Well, does the key, so there is still a key on that fob?
Yeah.
Yes, there is a hidden lock cylinder on that car somewhere.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. And it's not that well hidden, but you bought this new?
Yes.
And the salesman didn't, of course, tell you anything about that.
He absolutely did not. Sounds like the instruction manual needs to be pulled out again.
Yeah, look in the owner's manual, but they used to be on some cars on the bottom of the door handle where you won't see it. Or what model car do you have?
It's a Tiguan.
Okay, at the rear lift gate, you look underneath it where you would put your hand in there to open it, there could be a key slot that angles up from the bottom, again, where you won't see it. But I'm pretty sure that car has a lock cylinder somewhere on the outside in case this happens to you.
Yeah, because I got three keys with it.
Yeah.
And as far as I can tell, the only thing it's good for is the glove compartment. But as you're saying, not.
Take a look around the outside of that car. I'm almost certain there is.
That's a fun mystery. Kurt, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go over to Bill in Albany. Bill, you there?
Yes, I am.
You're on.
Good afternoon. Okay, I have a problem. When I was a kid and I needed to put air into my bicycle tires, freaked me out. I always had problems. Then I became a young adult and I bought a motorcycle. Same thing. Now I own a truck, Toyota truck, and when the tire pressure gauge light comes on, I freak. I go to the gas station, deposit my 75 cents, try to put air into the tires, and the light doesn't go off. And I overinflate it or I underinflate it. So I'm asking, is there a machine that I can buy and wear, bring home, plug it in, and do it at home and not embarrass myself?
You mean to inflate your tires?
Yes.
Yeah. Does your truck, I don't think an 08 Tacoma will identify which tire is the soft one, will it? Does your...
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
It could be the spare as well. But, you know, I run around and I put air in the left tire, the right tire, the rear tire, and I overinflate it.
Yeah.
And then I have to take it to the shop when there's something wrong and ask them to check it out.
Yeah. Get yourself a good quality digital tire pressure gauge. And that way you can go around and check every one of them and make sure they're all almost identical, same pressure. And if you look on the plaque on the door of the truck when you open the door, there'll be a little card there that's stuck to the
right.
door pill. It tells you what the tire pressures are. And if your spare tire is a full-size spare and it takes the same pressure as the rest of them, you may have a sensor in the spare wheel that also needs to be checked, which very seldom ever does. So when the vehicle is 5-6 years old, the spare is down to 18 pounds, and it drives you crazy because you check all the other tires, and they're up to the correct pressure, but the warning light's still on.
Oh, interesting.
So get a tire pressure gauge of your own, and then just check them all, and you'll be good.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. The number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop. Gordon Fricke is our guest, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from the Honest Wait Food Co-op, 100 Watervliet Ave, Albany, New York, specializing in local and organic produce, natural groceries, fine cheeses, locally raised meats, and ready-to-go organic meals. HonestWait.coop. The Whistling Kettle Tea Room, tea shops and cafes in Ballston Spa and downtown Troy, New York. Over 170 loose-leaf teas from around the world, in-store and online. TheWhistlingKettle.com. Northshire Bookstore, offering Northshire Selects, a book a month chosen by their booksellers. Northshire.com. And Haydenville Woodworking and Design, a group of artisans designing and building renovations, additions, new homes, custom cabinets, and furniture for over 30 years. HaydenvilleWD.com for virtual portfolio.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Gordon Fricke is our guest, and boy, did we get taken to task, huh?
Oh, yeah.
What happened?
You mean regarding my daughter's?
Yeah.
Well,
I heard she was sending us nasty notes.
Well, she just said that she most certainly can multitask, and I guess we need to get the medical guys involved if the human brain really, truly can multitask, or is they just say this generation can?
Well, let's see what grade she gets on the report.
That's probably going to be pretty good.
All right, we'll find out. All right, this one came in from Bill from Greenville, but he had to hang up. He's driving. So wants to know why there's no such thing as a front-wheel drive pickup truck.
It's a good question, because in the U.S., trucks were always traditionally rear-wheel drive. Back in the early days of Model T pickup trucks on up to now, you had what we called a conventional front-engine rear-drive layout. And they were heavy, robust, big, solid cast-iron axles, hold a lot of weight. Go over to Europe and Asia, and their pickup trucks, which really don't resemble ours, primarily evolved from the efficient cars of their era. And a lot of them are front-wheel drive. The rear axle just kind of tags along for the ride. So it goes back to our truck roots in early trucks in the U.S., I'm sure.
There are no front-wheel drive trucks available in this market?
No. Years ago, you had some mini trucks. Volkswagen Rabbit had one.
Yeah.
Dodge had something. I can't remember what they called it, but it looked like a Rabbit pickup, which was a car, turned into a little miniature pickup truck.
Nice.
But primarily, it's rear-wheel drive, and then, of course, everything is four-wheel drive today in trucks for the most part.
All right, let's go to John in Gilderland. John, you're on.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. I just have a couple of, they're both related questions. I have a 1975 MGB, And I was curious as to whether or not, given that year, I need to put a lead additive into the fuel.
Unleaded gas and catalytic converters were mandatory, not mandatory, but most vehicles had to have them in 1974. A couple of your fuel-injected European cars still got good enough emissions grades where they didn't need a catalytic converter. Your MGB, if it's a carbureted engine, which I think it was.
Carbureted engine.
Yeah. If that vehicle has a catalytic converter or came equipped with one, the valves and all the stuff in the engine are fine with unleaded gasoline.
Okay.
And if you add lead, which you can't get anymore, but lead additives to cars with catalytic converters, I don't know if there's any ill effects. So you should see if you have a if that car came with a catalytic converter, or if there's a sticker somewhere near the gas door or the cap that says only use unleaded, because that sticker was mandatory at the time also.
Okay, very good. Now, I also have a 1955 Thunderbird, Ford Thunderbird.
Well, all right.
Now, that car was, when I bought it restored, but I don't know whether or not, is there a process that you can perform that will enable a car to take unleaded gas? Because that car clearly, needed leaded gas.
Yeah. Yeah. The main change when unleaded gas became the thing to use was it was in the valve train of the engine. The valve seats and the valves were of a harder material. So no, there's no quick and easy fix for an old car like that. For that Thunderbird, you why not use the lead additive? It's not that expensive for the few miles you probably drive it.
Okay, very good. Thank you for taking the call.
You're
John,
welcome.
Thank you very much. Our number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. We talk cars and trucks with Gordon Fricke every so often, and he's here today. Let's go to George in Syracuse. George, are you in Syracuse or on the way to Syracuse?
No, I live in Syracuse, but I'm on the road today.
All right, well, you're on the air with Gordon Fricke.
Thank you. I've got a 2007 Mitsubishi Outlander. A couple of months ago on the dash, the ASC light came on. I took it to a garage. They diagnosed it as a ABS module being bad. My question is, well, sort of twofold. I found out from it's a dealer only part. It's about $2,000 for this module.
Ouch!
And it was and it would seem to me also that if it's an ABS module causing the ASC light to be on, wouldn't the ABS light be on as well? Because according to the to the garage, the ABS wasn't working. So I'm a little wondering if maybe they diagnosed it wrong or not. Because I don't have an ABS light on, just the ASC, which I believe is a assisted stability control.
Yeah. I believe that is automatic slip control. And is there a picture of a vehicle with kind of curvy lines like you're skidding or spinning?
No, just the ASC, just the letters.
Yeah. The ABS system and the slip control work together. It's the same system, mm-hmm. but kind of in reverse. When you're stepping on the brakes and the system wants to prevent your wheels from locking up, it reads your vehicle wheel speed sensors, and if it sees one rapidly slowing down, it takes the brakes away from it.
Right.
On the other hand, when you're accelerating and one of your drive wheels starts to spin, the system sees that that wheel is going faster than the rest of them.
It slows it down.
Yeah, and it works to slow that wheel down. So it's the same system working. So your question is very good. Do an experiment. Take the vehicle on a road with loose dirt, gravel, or something where you don't have a hard paved surface.
Right.
And try to lock the brakes up. And,
okay.
You know, be careful doing that. But see if your anti-lock, do you know what the anti-lock feels like when it does operate? If the
It's almost like a slight shutter as it rapidly pulses the brakes.
Yeah. See if the vehicle still does that. If you find that you are now able to lock those wheels up, then that system is definitely down. The next thing you want to try to do on that same road with not the greatest traction is see if the wheel slip works. Really accelerate super hard and see if your wheels will slip or start spinning out of control or if the system grabs them and slows them down.
Yeah, but be careful. Be careful.
Obviously,
doing that.
But it still would seem to me that if it's all controlled by this ABS module and it's not working, wouldn't that put an ABS light on as well as the ASC light?
It could, unless the logic part of the control module is only having problems in the slip control part of it. But but I think it would be definitely a good idea, because it's such an expensive repair, to get another opinion.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Appreciate
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Is the ASC light or the ASC sensor a deal breaker when it comes to a New York State inspection?
No. So far, cars can be can pass inspections with an ABS warning light on or a slip control warning light on.
But eventually,
I don't know. I
the
say,
bureaucrats will.
I say so far. I don't know. Maybe they will start going into that.
Okay. Let's go to Jonathan, who's on the road. Jonathan, you're on.
Yes. Hi, Gordon and Ray. My wife and I have a BMW X3. It's an 03. I believe it's a 3.0 six-cylinder. We recently brought it in for an oil change with our regular service people, and they noticed oil accumulating around the oil pan, and they mentioned that there's a front drive shaft, I guess, that goes actually through the oil pan area of the engine on BMWs.
Yep.
I guess the question is, whether we were using oil or not, it was suggested to us, they cleaned it up, they looked around underneath, they looked up in the front of the engine. They said they thought they saw some seepage coming from the front crankshaft seal. Now, when they discovered that that might have been the cause of it, they suggested we call the dealer. The dealer told us they'd never heard of that. It's got 116,000 miles on it. They told us they'd never heard of a BMW X3 actually having that problem. But they said if the front seal's leaking, the rear seal probably is as well. They instructed us a pretty expensive repair, a lot of specialized tools. The next thing they suggested was take it on a long drive. So we had the oil changed. It was right up on the stick. I just drove 400 miles. I checked it the next morning, and you could not register any oil use on the stick. So we don't know if that oil accumulated over a significant period of time, because, of course, we didn't notice it until the next oil change interval. I'm not quite sure what we should do. We're a little concerned. You know, it could be, is this a problem, or should we just continue to monitor it? Or
sure. Well, here's what I see on that vintage six-cylinder BMW engine. We run into a fair amount of oil leakage from the seal that goes between the oil filter housing or the oil filter adapter in the engine block. There's a preformed rubber type of a gasket that gets hard and brittle when the cars get older. And they will leak oil from that. It's not uncommon at all.
Interesting.
And also, the crankcase ventilation system on that engine is a bit too intricate, and it's made out of plastic, and it's in a horrible location. And what happens is, in the olden days, you used to call it a PCV valve, positive crankcase ventilation. On Ray's 65 Le Mans, it was a $3 item and took 15 minutes to change. And it was a breather around the other end of it, and it was a very easy system to service and keep maintained. Now on these cars, it's so overcomplicated, but we would take all afternoon to talk about why they do things like that. But I see those systems failing fairly often on that vintage vehicle as well. And then the crankcase doesn't get ventilated properly, and pressure builds up, and it causes oil to ooze and seep out of areas that it may not normally ever come out of. So it
But wouldn't that show up after a 400-mile drive?
Well, like I said, it certainly wasn't registrable on the dipstick.
Yeah.
Now, what I haven't been able to do, because I've been driving in rain all day, is take a look at it tomorrow morning, you know, in the garage when it's dried up, to see if there's oil accumulation on the pan.
Have you noticed any drips under the vehicle prior to getting it all cleaned up? I mean, would it leave a little drop here and there on the floor, or is it parked outside?
Again, I have not noticed that. I will have to pay more attention to it. I thought I'd still had a piece of cardboard under there when I got home tonight, actually, and see if it helped me to register it. You know?
Yeah, but those two things are frequent flyers that we see on those vehicles, the gasket on the oil filter housing and the crankcase ventilation system, which is under the intake manifold.
Okay.
Both are nasty jobs.
other words, a lot of billable hours.
Well, yeah, they're not. It's not a Le Mans PCV valve.
Too bad. Well, good luck, Jonathan. Good luck, Jonathan. Hey, that's interesting.
Well, thank you.
All right, give us a shout when you find out what it is. Okay.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's go to Paul on the road. Boy, everybody's on the road. Are you hands free, Paul?
I am.
All right. Well, you are on with Gordon Fricke.
All right. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I got a 2006 Toyota pickup with a tailgate that one side of it is locked and the other side is not. So I tried YouTubing this thing and the issue with it. And my question is there a button of some sort or something on the lock side of the tailgate that I can either push or whatever to get that side unlocked is my question.
Yeah. On the inside of the tailgate, is there a panel that can be removed with some screws to expose the kind of the guts of the tailgate?
Yeah, I actually there's two. There's a top cap piece on the top of the tailgate, and then there's one solid piece that makes the wall of the tailgate on the inside of the bed.
Yeah.
I took both of them off. Actually, no, I took the top one off. And I couldn't take the wall piece off only because my tailgate is still up and it's locked on that one side, so I can't pull it off.
Yeah.
But I can see on the inside that there are two very small bars that go to the tailgate handle. And I actually pulled and tugged and tried everything on the side where it's locked, and it still just won't release, and yeah. I don't know why.
Does the tailgate not get used that often? Is it up most of the time on your truck?
Not really. What happened, to make a long story short, is I put some dirt in the back, and the dirt was up against the tailgate. So when I went to shut it, it either pushed it or did something to it where, again, it locked on one side and it didn't lock on the other. So
yeah, what I would try to do is see if you can get some penetrating oil with a nozzle, you know, the straw that's on those cans,
yep.
And see if you can shoot it right at the latch on the stuck side. Spray them both, but. If it's a rusty, you know, if something got corroded in there, it's stuck. If you let that penetrating oil soak in there, do it a couple of times, and then with a pull on the latch, you know, bang on it. Maybe it'll take two people, but see if you can get that latch to pop free. Maybe there's some gravel or dirt that's stuck in there, but I think you're going to have to give it some hits with maybe a rubber mallet with another person on the latch. And just keep working it and get some penetrating oil and try it. You'll probably get it open that way.
All right, sounds good. I got one more comment on that guy with the air pressure problem with his Toyota earlier.
Yeah.
I had the same issue with my light coming on with my tires. And what the problem was that the sensor in the spare was setting off that light sensor on the dashboard. So what my mechanic did, because he found that out, is he put a little air in the spare, and it stopped that sensor light coming on.
Yeah, we run into that a lot because the spares get overlooked all the time.
Paul,
yeah.
Thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. Now, if you have a miniature donut, it will not have the sensor?
Correct. Okay. If you look on your tire plaque, and that spare tire is a pressure of, let's say, 60,
yeah,
that's an indication you've got a mini spare with no sensor in it. Because if the pressure's are that drastic, if the spare pressure is way higher than the rest of them, there's no sensor in it.
Mm, okay, let's go back over to the phones and Jim in Warwick, Mass. Jim, you're on.
How you doing?
Good.
I have a 1951 Pontiac. The straight eight. The engine's been rebuilt, and I drive it less than 5,000 miles per year. It's been completely restored. My question would be, I'd like Gordon's opinion regarding whether to use synthetic oil or not. And I had heard earlier that he suggested that regardless, I would change the oil annually. Would that be so for this vehicle as well?
Yeah, sure. If you drive it to any degree over that year, you got a lot of start and stops. You've been idling the car. And people with cars like that tend not to take them on good long trips where everything gets really nice at operating temperature for hours at a time. So you're going to have moisture and acids and stuff in that crankcase that wants to get drained out. So do it every year. And on a car like yours, I would use a oil for vintage engines that has a zinc content in it. And there's a bunch of them, a handful of them out there.
Okay.
And it's for engines of that era where the types of valve lifters and tappets, there was a lot of metal-to-metal contact. So they wanted some zinc in that oil to help, you know, soften that blow a little bit. But I wouldn't use synthetic. You're only doing it once a year. That old engine is going to like conventional oil.
Okay.
So that's what I would do. And I wouldn't be overly concerned about non-detergent, because in those days there were some non-detergent oils. But the fact that that engine's been rebuilt, just use good quality vintage motor oil, change it once a year, and you'll be fine.
Okay. I do take it on long rides, by the way.
That's great. Yeah, that's good for it.
Okay.
Thanks, Jim.
All right.
Appreciate
Thank
the
you.
Call. So where do you get vintage motor oil? Just like heirloom vegetables?
Hemmings has their own packaged up brand. It's their own name on it. I have a bunch of old cars, and I discovered, I think Valvoline has this high zinc formula for older cars.
Huh.
And you can get heavier weights. You can get 2050, which today is very uncommon. But on an older, looser, bigger engine with bigger, you know, tolerances and dimensions, that 2050 is a nice oil for an old engine like that.
Gordon Fricke is our guest. The number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. We'll take a break, and then it's the home stretch.
Support comes from Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making and design services from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs. In downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, amherstcopy.com. Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Over 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more. Harold's.com. Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts. A community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment. Berkshire.coop. And the Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, educating children pre-K through grade 12 and striving to inspire a lifelong love of learning. WaldorfSaratoga.org.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551, the number, or you can email us, voxpopwamc.org. And Gordon, this one came in via email from Dick in New Hampshire. Came with a picture.
It's oh, boy.
A C picture. My daughter has a Chevy S10, about 2003. Driver's side front wheel is not too good. Online stores show a wheel bearing assembly for four-wheel drive, but ours is not four-wheel drive, and they do not look like the one on the car. Help.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a conventional tapered roller bearing because it's a two-wheel drive. Bringing your old Le Mans back into the mix here, this is exactly what was on the front of your car.
I remember it well.
And you could take that, you see that nut on the end there. I don't know if you can see that picture from
yeah.
where you're sitting. There's a cotter pin, a nut, a big washer, and then there's the outer bearing. And you remove those things and the hub comes off, and then you take out the seal and the inner bearing. This is so damaged that to me it looks like it's probably going to need a hub, maybe a spindle. There's some pretty heavy damage in there. She's lucky the wheel didn't come off.
Yeah.
So, those parts are all still easily available.
Good.
Yeah.
Number to call here is 800-348-2551. Back to the phones we go, and Mike in Niskayuna. Mike, you're on.
Hi. My question is twofold. I'm a carpenter. I drive a 2005 Ford Econoline van, as does my electrician and my plumber, and we love them, but only to find out recently that they're not making them anymore. Is there a reason for that?
You know, I don't know. I'm sure the reason, if you talk to the heads of Ford, it's got to be something to do with numbers. You know, the popularity has tapered off on that van, and now you're seeing all these transit and inner city and more European style vans coming into the picture. So they're being replaced by a different style of van. Is that what you're encountering?
Yeah, because I mean, the Transit makes two or three different sizes, but this van has been outstanding. I haven't had any problem with it. I'm in my 10th year. And like I said, all of my other trades people, friends, I feel the same way.
Yeah, yeah. No, that Econoline was a strong, full-framed, it was basically a pickup truck enclosed.
Yeah.
So they were a good, rugged work truck for sure.
The other question I had is, and probably goes back to the other caller, why don't they manufacture, back in the day, the vans with a four-wheel drive?
Yeah, again, I'm sure it was pure numbers. I'm sure Ford execs said, you think we can sell a lot of these in four-wheel drive? And I'm sure the consensus was no.
Yeah.
With pickup trucks, you got guys plowing snow, going off-road, going hunting, and nobody's doing that, really, in these vans.
I ran into a friend of mine at the lumberyard, and he actually, I don't know how he got it, but he somehow managed to get a kit, and either that or he had a garage do it. I don't know exactly.
Yeah.
And he managed to, you know, put a four-wheel drive into his van.
Yep.
I think it was so expensive, though.
It is. There's a company that makes them, and we service the local fleet of ambulances in our area, and one of their Econoline 350s is a conversion to four-wheel drive.
Oh,
really
good.
Cool setup. Company is called Quigley, Quigley. If you go online, Google that, you'll find them.
I mean, this van is fairly good in snow because I'm frequently carrying, you know, anywhere between 500 and 1,000 pounds.
Yeah. With weight and good tires, you'll be okay.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. We appreciate the call. Now, these conversions, are those the old manual hubs where you have to go out? Really?
Yeah, it's a real cool system. They put an older style F-350 front end in it, and these particular ones have hubs, manual hubs, and an extra shift lever that takes it in and out of four-wheel drive, like an old-school four-wheel drive truck.
Oh, pretty good.
So it's very bulletproof.
All right, let's go over to Ed in Catskill. Ed, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hi, I've got a quick question about my tires. I have a Subaru Impreza 2015.
Okay, connection's not too good here, but give it your best shot. Hello?
Can you hear me now?
Yep, better.
Okay, look, I have a 2015 Subaru, and I'm pulling because it comes with a donut spare. And what the manual says is if you get a flat tire in the front, you actually have to take one of the tires off the back and put it on the front. It only uses a spare on the back.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's a little inconvenient.
It is. And it has to do with the all-wheel drive setup on that car. And I think the majority of the torque is being directed to the front wheels primarily. Even though that spare stands the same height as all the other tires to keep them all rolling at the same speed, they probably feel that the skinny donut spare is going to slip and not get the traction that the other tire is and confuse the system. So I'm sure that's why they want the two full-size tires up front and let the spare tag along in the back. I'm sure that's the case.
Maybe you just get a full-size spare.
The only problem is I don't think you'll fit it in the spot where that little mini spare is in because they've, you know, trimmed everything
maximized
down space.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's terrible.
Yep. So I think that's the only thing you can do with it.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yep.
Sorry about that. Another satisfied customer. Ron in South Hadley, Mass. Ron, you're on.
Hi, Gordon.
Hello.
I have a 2008 Hyundai Tucson V6, and I recently had the brakes done. And when I was sitting in the dealer's lot, I decided, because the brake pedal was kind of mushy before the brake job, I decided to explore the how firm the brake would be. And what I found was bizarre. I don't know what to think of it as an X-Shade pre-mechanic. Is that when I maintain a substantial pedal pressure, not ludicrous, but pretty firm, that pedal eventually goes to the floor, retreats from me. And I keep following it with my foot, and it retreats after a moment, and then it retreats, and we wind up all the way down.
Yikes.
So you're saying right to the floorboard.
Yeah. Driving it around the city, you wouldn't notice it. You don't usually put that much force on a pedal. But just standing with the engine running, and keep applying a heavy force to it which I'm sure have exceeded in emergency situations. You know, when you're in a panic and you're trying to push the wheel through the firewall.
Right.
But that pedal retreats from me. What's the likely culprit?
How many miles are on that car, do you know, roughly?
About 77,000.
That's pretty low mileage. A sinking brake pedal traditionally was the master cylinder leaking by internally. So you're not leaking any fluid outside, but it's sneaking by the pistons and those cup seals. Yeah. And, you know, the textbook case of a failing master cylinder was that you'd keep steady pressure on the pedal, and it would very slowly go right to the floor.
If you, this does it in increments. So I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it does it in increments.
And this is with the car not moving. You're just sitting there with it running at a stop.
Yep.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to just go say it's the master cylinder, but if you're not leaking any fluid externally, and it truly will go right to the end of its stroke, which is just about on the floor, that's not normal. As long as you're not inadvertently pressing a little harder than you think you are, but even still, you shouldn't be able to push that pedal that far. Now, if you were pushing the brake pedal that hard at 30 or 40 miles an hour, you may be coming to a screeching halt by then. So you got to be a little bit careful of your sensation when the vehicle's not moving. We do a lot of brake work, and when we bleed brakes in the shop, sometimes we feel that the pedal is not at the right location, but when we go out and drive the car, it's perfect.
Huh.
So your brain can fool you when you're sitting at a stop and pushing the pedal. And I've had this happen a lot with cars that have hydro boost systems, which yours doesn't. But Audi 5000s in the olden days had them, and a lot of GMs and Chevy pickups have them. That system is so powerful that you can push that brake pedal almost to the floor because of the expansion of all the hoses and moving of all the parts and squeezing the brake pads. But if you ever were on the highway and you didn't have anti-lock brakes, your wheels would have locked up way before then.
Uh-huh.
So I'd take it with a grain of salt. Drive it, see how it feels, you know?
Okay.
Ron, thank you so much for the call. Jim in Skodak. Jim.
Hi. I have a 2006 Volvo S60, and it's all-wheel drive, and I'm only getting drive out of the front wheels. Do you know what I should look at to troubleshoot that?
How many miles are on that car?
178,000.
So if you accelerate hard, like on the grass or dirt, you'll spin your front wheels like crazy. Nothing happens in the rear.
Yeah, I noticed it in the snow last year, like only the front wheels were driving.
Yeah. Here's what can be the issue, and not all the time, but with that mileage, Volvo has a unit right behind the transmission that they call an angle gear. Some call it a transfer case, but that's a little elaborative a term on this car, but it takes the torque out of the transmission and turns it around and heads it to the drive shaft to your rear wheels. And that angle gear has a shaft inside of a shaft, and those splines can deteriorate and fail. And you'll never hear it. You'll never know it. You'll just have a total front-wheel drive car.
Right.
And so that needs to be checked. Also, in the rear, the differential is torque sensing. So Volvos coast around on two-wheel drive until the wheels slip, and then it turns the back axle on. So there's electronics and a clutch mechanism in the back. So it's not easy. You got to differentiate whether it's not engaging the rear axle or the rear axle's not getting the power from the angle gear. But if the angle gear is the culprit, put the car on a lift with all four wheels off, and you find that the drive shaft isn't connected to the transmission anymore, it's probably that unit up front.
Okay.
Both of which are not the least expensive endeavors, but it does happen to those cars. And but I would get it checked out with somebody that knows those systems.
So it's not an expensive fix?
Oh, no, it can be. Yeah.
It's not a cheap fix, he says.
Yeah, it can be.
Oh, it's not a cheap fix.
Can be expensive.
It is, after all, a Volvo.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Over to Jason in Massachusetts. Jason, you're on.
Yes. I got a 97 Chevy Cavalier, and long story short, my wife hit a little piece of debris on the highway, got home, and my camshaft pulley is wobbling. I'm at the point where I'm kind of wondering whether the pulley could have been bent or if the camshaft got bent.
All I think, are you talking about the shaft
main pulley
at the bottom of the engine where the belts all wrap around?
That's the one.
Yeah, okay, that's the crankshaft pulley.
Okay.
Which is, those pulleys on your car, I'm not sure, but a lot of them were called a harmonic balancer. So the pulley had a rubber built into the middle of it to take the vibrations away.
Okay.
And they're replaceable. If it's got a nasty wobble, you definitely want to get it replaced because it'll come apart or you know, fail or walk off the end of the shaft. So I would definitely get it looked at. And if the balancer is starting to deteriorate, you'll want to get that replaced. And that's not really a nasty job on that car.
Okay, great.
Thanks
Thank
a
you
lot.
Very much.
Appreciate the call, Jason. Here's one that came in via email from Kate. I drive a 2001 VW Cabrio. It still has the stock radio, and I usually use it to listen to iPod music. Not WAMC? I should just rip this up right now. Hooked up through a cassette. A couple of weeks ago while I was driving, the radio suddenly showed the words tape error across the screen, beeped, and stopped playing music. In case this is relevant, I had been driving for about 2.5 hours on the highway, and the car has a tendency to overheat a little, which I can remedy by cranking the heat. Anyway, since that day, the radio says there's no tape in the machine, the tape will not eject, and the radio will play for 10-second periods, broken up by beeps and 5-second silences, during which the words error appear across the screen. As my grandmother would say, that's the genie punishing for not listening to WAMC.
That's right.
No, so what's the word?
Well, she, at that stage of the game, it could be that the radio is done. Because who fixes those anymore? Who takes them apart? Nobody.
Yeah.
If she's attempted to take that cassette out, if it comes out, I would try to play a cassette, a music cassette,
yeah,
and just see if that works. And if neither work, you can try to power the car down, disconnect the battery, reconnect it. Even on that vintage car, though, it might now say code because it's a theft-proof radio.
Ah.
So if she doesn't have the code handy, she's going to have a locked-up radio for no code, and it's done anyway. So.
Before she does that, if she can get the adapter out, my first bet is it's the adapter that's shot.
It could very well be.
Or clean the heads. In the old days, you just get a Q-tip with some isopropyl alcohol,
yeah,
get the 92 or 93%, and clean those heads off.
I have a vintage car that I bought new with a cassette player in it.
Yeah.
And I still have the head cleaning kit for the cassette,
yeah,
in the car with the little tube of alcohol, which I'm sure is dried up 20 years ago. But yeah, that was a big deal back then.
Yeah, I mean, they also have, for those who don't remember cassette players, they also have little plastic, they look like cassettes, but they're just cleaners.
Yeah.
They're not the best thing for the heads, but you can use them a couple
of times.
Yeah, they
kind of wipe the, jiggles around in there and they wipe the heads off.
So I would suggest that that might be the issue, or
yeah,
the adapter itself. Let's go to Neil quickly in Sharon Springs. Neil, you're on.
Hi there. I just wanted to make a comment about the man having trouble with his air pressure in his tires.
Yeah, okay.
Had the same problem. And if he goes to one of the newer gas stations, the new equipment will stop. Precisely, you can preset the pressure. It will stop exactly at the right pressure.
Ah, well,
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah. Go to a new.
If you have too much pressure, it'll take it down too.
Good idea.
Makes a great Christmas gift. Thanks a lot for the call. All right, very quickly here, let's go to Ben in Sheffield, Mass.
I can call you back.
Hey Ben, you're on the radio.
Okay. Goodbye.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah. This is. I have a '98 Chevy Cavalier.
All right.
And the dome light quit. Now, you know, this car has timers for everything. If I leave the door open, eventually the dome lights go out. If I leave the headlights on, eventually the headlights go out. If, you know, the ding-ding on the ignition key, if I leave the door open, that ding-ding eventually stops.
All right.
The lights that aren't working are glove compartment, dome light, and trunk.
Fuse.
And there must be a separate timer. Do you know much about this?
I think Ray just answered the question.
Check the fuse, man.
Yeah, go to the owner's manual.
Oh, no, it's not the fuse. No, we did all of that.
Now, sometimes
all of that. We checked the flow on the fuse. There's, you know, there's flow going through the fuse.
So it's not corrosion on the fuse, back of the fuse box?
No, they checked the flow on the fuse.
Okay.
It's going from one side to the other.
We only got about 15 seconds here, Gordon.
Yeah, to identify what times them on and off. I don't think they're all on the same timer. They could be all on the same circuit, but
different timers. Yeah,
I would
timers,
get a,
you're under the dash.
I would get a test light on the dome light. Take the bulb out.
That's happened. That's all also been done. There's no
okay.
flow to it.
Alas, we are out of time, Ben. I apologize, and I'm sorry that you had to hang up on your other call. But we are done here, and you know, good luck. Gordon, good luck. You made it through. You had a cold, and
yes.
you did all right.
Yeah, somebody gave me a cold, and I cannot find them.
We'll make
I want
them
that
pay.
Person.
Yes, exactly. Support comes, and on that vindictive note, we end the program. Support comes from the Albany Pine Bush Preserve, presenting the 7th Annual Cookie Burner Stroll on December 26th, an outdoor guided exercise hike for ages 10 and up. Pre-registration is required. AlbanyPineBush.org. Unusual wedding rings at Moore and Crawford Square, North Street, downtown Pittsfield. Specializing in wedding and engagement rings with a variety of jewelry for special occasions or everyday wear. UnusualWeddingRings.com. And Destination Williamstown, a calendar of curated events in the Northern Berkshires, culture, college, cows. DestinationWilliamstown.org. Thanks again to Gordon Fricke. Thanks to you for listening and for calling. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. And thanks to Deb Malik for answering the phones. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's a Food Friday.